Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In this presentation, I will bring together a number of ideas and approaches that have occurred over the years. First of all, I will take a basic interpretation of the term strategic. I will then add some layers to it when we lead through design. Then I'll take a short break and reiterate who the key players are in this strategic game, which will then be followed by looking at various levels at which design professionals contribute to strategic planning. And given that this is a design management conference, I will conclude by proposing that the key issues that define the discipline of design management could be viewed as a value chain, a principal source through which design professionals add value, create competitive advantage, and deliver their strategic contributions. So please fasten your seat belts for the journey. What is strategic in business? Many who use the term mean little more than very important. Drilling down a bit, we find that the most basic interpretation is an aspect of strategy, which means that you are contributing strategically if you are actually involved in the formulation of strategies or provide inputs into their content. Additionally, strategic contributions arise when you facilitate the implementation of strategies and help enhance their effectiveness over time. Now, design and design specialists contribute in all these ways. However, we should keep in mind that strategies can be routine if aspirations are low, objectives are unambitious, and resources are inadequate. So let's drill deeper still. Early in the 1980s, Kenichi Omai specified that strategy, hence strategic contributions, should create competitive advantage and differentiate an organization positively. Now, differentiation can include both separating out from the crowd and also distancing from competitors, ideally creating gaps that can't be closed quickly, so providing extra time to maneuver and reposition yourself. Now, there are significant contributions here from designers. I mean, in a tough market, for example, if you introduce a new price point into a market, which is 30% of what the previous price point was, you create quite a difference and you create quite a competitive advantage. If in a market where downtime is very unwelcome because of pressures of work, if you reduce service times from 2 days down to 30 minutes, that is, again, a significant difference and a significant competitive advantage. Kenichi also stipulated that strategies should build relative strengths and satisfy needs more effectively. Now, building relative strengths can be developing new sets of skills so that you can offer novel services. In terms of satisfying needs more effectively, I like the example of the company that is offering its technology with licenses which have design management support. And in this way, they ensure that their technology is used to best effect, shows its full potential, and encourages more companies to take out licenses. Perhaps the toughest characteristic is that strategic actions, contributions, should have an enduring impact on the fundamental relationship between an organization, its target audiences, and operating environments. Now, design is all around us. It is at every point of contact between an organization, its target audiences, and its operating environment. And therefore, it is very well placed to have a significant influence on all of these. Indeed, frequently, it is the principal influence on the perceptions and interactions of target audiences with organizations and what they offer. The question is, let me give you an example of that. There was a business school that was new, this is going back some time, which never had any applicants who put them as their first choice. The quality of the applicants was actually not particularly high, and the numbers were low. Following the work of a design firm in introducing some publicity material, the following year, they trebled the number of applicants, a third of which put that business school as their first choice. So there was a significant change in the perception of a target audience to this particular organization. The question is, of course, is an organization a proactive leader or is it a struggling follower? Now, I'm using a very basic diagram that we used at business school. This is going back to the end of the 60s, actually, where you have a current environment organization that interacts with its current environment, and you have key influences on the relationship and competitive advantages are created. And as time passes, you have the future organization, the organization changes, and you have a future environment. Now, does the organization influence the environment more than the environment influences the organization? Now, the proactive leader is one that generates new product and service concepts that change market and industry's perceptions. They pioneer new materials and processes which sometimes counter the mainstream thinking in those industries. They may harness disruptive technologies or innovations which are creative elsewhere. And they can form alliances with competitors to exploit emerging markets. So they are actually taking the lead. They're not accepting what is going on out there. By contrast, a struggling follower tends to be confined to responding to changes which are prompted or imposed from outside. Now, this might be because the organization does not have the means to sense or make sense of what is going on outside, or it fails to keep pace with such changes. Now, I'd like to add some more characteristics to strategic, the term strategic, that I think would occur if we were to lead through design. There is a common misconception that strategic contributions are linked only to the long term. Certainly, as you can imagine, this is essential when a long-term perspective and impact are required. However, there's also a need for contributions that are explosive and have a short-term focus. Now, this might be because they have to respond quickly to competitor actions, or they have to grasp opportunities without delay. What is interesting is that in every instance, even with tactical initiatives, we should look for how we can set down roots so that we transform, say, a one-off short-term tactical move, if it's that, to a sustained position, long-term position. So even when we talk tactics, we should be looking for how can we turn this into a sustainable strategic advantage. Agility is demonstrated both in the speed at which we can take action and also how quickly the benefits can be reaped. The second thing is windows of relevance and periods of erosion. Now, you can imagine that when you have lead times, which are sometimes extend to years, it's quite difficult to foretell what will resonate when you're going to launch a service or a product, maybe several years ahead. Now, there's considerable evidence that design professionals are very successful at that. For example, a technical director expressed to me that they had introduced designers into their new product development process. These are consultant designers, because they can communicate futuristically with their users, term he used. Another, in fact, was a managing director, said that contrary to our marketing colleagues who provide us with extrapolations of where we are today, we get leaps forward in thinking from our designers. And things that we consider to be way out when they propose them actually turn out to be absolutely right when the time came to launch the product. Now, the ideal way of tackling the periods of erosion is if you've got a good strategic position advantage, the way to sustain that is to keep churning out these exciting strategic improvements or changes. And therefore, you are, in a sense, not only as the power is diminishing, you then boost it up, and you get this continuous stream of interest and advantage which is sustained. Today we are dealing with complex situations. There are multiple entry and exit points in the use of products and services. We have these different points are in terms of the stage at which people come in and go out, the timing, the choice of platforms they use, the interfaces they use, and the products and services that are in play. Now, solutions need to be tolerant and robust to accommodate the idiosyncrasies of users as they do their own thing in their own way, some of which changes daily. Increasingly, extra senses are being brought into these experiences. And of course, mastery of the expertise that is associated with those extra senses has to be incorporated in the mix. And as boundaries are set wider, whether it's because of ambition or necessity, we find that there's an increasing need to innovate serially. You find that because you're bringing more things together, you're actually innovating several times. Whereas before, I remember at business school, I was advised never innovate more than once in any initiative. It's too much, you know. Well, that's not good enough anyway. And interestingly, we have the pressures to kiss. When complexity increases, it is essential to resist the temptation to jettison complexity that enlightens so as not to end up with simplicity that is opaque. Keep it simple, stupid often masks intellectual apathy, insensitivity, and a lack of true understanding. It was interesting that on the World Service, BBC World Service, there was a discussion, Peter Day, on world business, global business, and he had an economist there, and the economist said, get rid of KISS, it is irrelevant now. We need complexity because that's the only way we can actually grasp what is happening around us. Living briefs. Because we have changing situations, complex changing situations, we need briefs that are dynamic. The snapshots that we used to have before of preconceived uses at various times, which used to be the kind of brief that was given, specifications are no longer enough. What we need is a briefing that reflects the dynamism that exists out there. So living briefs provide vision of the desired experiences to be generated through solutions. They bring to life the richness of the requirements and the issues. They bring in the backstories, you know, that are behind the headlines. And they set out the desired performances over a range of circumstances. Now, the living brief is actually lived by all who are involved in the project constantly. They are rehearsing it, and it is changing as they gain more experience of coming to terms with the requirements that they are challenged with. So it is truly a living brief in that sense. Creative solutions will not always survive if they are executed indifferently and the support is uncaring. If we are going to protect the integrity of creative solutions, that involvement, that protection, must extend to implementation right through to launch and beyond sustaining the solution in the market. A solution that at launch is stripped of all the characteristics that commended it at the sanctioning stage represents a futile, wasted opportunity. When designers are involved, when designers lead, they are always switched on. Design leaders, like innovation leaders, have to feed their organizations with a stream of proposals of what could be done. They don't wait from project to be galvanized into action. They want their organizations to be constantly switched on to the opportunities. And therefore, they, in a sense, maintain energy and enthusiasm between the formal activity in the organization. And when you're involved in that way, it is essential, especially when you're involved with change, it is essential that you ensure that the transitions between the old phase and the new phase is smooth and is handled wisely. And therefore, in a sense, design leaders have got to be very competent at managing the transition between the old phase before they were involved or before they introduced their solutions to the new situation. Let's take a break now to consider the key characters in play. Clearly, we should look at all designers, whatever their background, whatever their training, specialization, or experience, when we are rooting out the strategic contributions that they make. So, firstly, we have professional designers, which includes the engineers, scientists, and so on, who deal with design. Now, these include, of course, industrial designers, or what would be better understood perhaps as design college graduates. Now, engineers and scientists are closer to research and development, so it is expected that they make strategic contributions. However, is their work considered design? Would they say that their work is design, or would they say it's engineering? It's science, you know, it's creating new knowledge and so on. And what of the work of the design college graduate? Constantly question marks. What do you mean by design? You don't ask an engineer or a scientist, what do you mean by designing a bridge or a road or whatever? But you do ask the design college graduate. And in a sense, how is their contribution to the organization's performance? treated alongside those of engineers and scientists? And what is the contact between engineers, scientists, and industrial designers? How do they interact? And how is their work coordinated so as to raise the chances of strategic contributions to arise? And I have there also the involvement of professional designers in non-design matters. Now, it is absolutely essential to document the contribution of professional designers in matters outside of design and when working with non-design teams, because otherwise you won't get an accurate picture of the value that they are generating. Business executives are the most powerful body of designers in the world. Might be surprising, but business executives are the ones who decide what problems are going to be addressed, how they will be tackled, the resources that are allocated, which concepts go through, how they are launched, and how they are supported in markets. They are ultimately responsible for the outcomes of design projects. And as research has shown, they actually have greater influence on the outcomes of design projects than the design specialists involved. And what is equally important is that they take and give credit for the contributions and achievements. And that is absolutely critical. Lastly, you'll be pleased, there are more and more individuals in business who are accumulating experience, considerable experience, at handling design very professionally, in enlightened ways, to the highest standards. I will lump them with professional designers and call them design professionals. The relative positioning of all these players in an organization will show, and how they see their roles and how they interact with each other, will provide pointers as to their chances of delivering strategic contributions. Now, there is another means of finding out how design professionals contribute strategically, and that is to look at their involvement in strategic planning. Now, their greatest influence, potentially, is when they have a credible role in strategic thinking. This is the area which could be viewed as a kind of primordial soup which is constantly bubbling away, in which or from which an organization's DNA evolves and its life is sustained. At this level, we stretch horizons, we broaden boundaries, we interpret what goes on out there. We suggest what could be done in areas of interest out there. We recommend new terrains to explore. We identify opportunities, champion initiatives, and bring together novel mixes of skills. The next level is helping with the formulation and communication of business missions, objectives, strategies, and plans. A further contribution would be in distilling the design implication and equivalence of all of these business decisions that have been made. So in terms of mission, you've got equivalent design mission. Objectives, design objectives. Strategies, design strategies, and design plans. The third level relates to the formulation of design strategies and corporate design plans. Now, these build on the corporate objectives and strategies which are specified by others. Design professionals work closely with their colleagues in other functions to ensure that the implications of design objectives and strategies are understood and valued by their colleagues. And design professionals are also instrumental in thinking through the implications for design of strategic decisions that have been taken in other functions. The fourth level, and the final one that I will deal with, is when design professionals flesh out a design work program to help implement design strategies based on decisions taken by others. Below this level, they're essentially tending to be confined to supplying and evaluating design-related data. I will now move on, look next at design management. A discipline where design professionals ought to have a unique expertise to add strategic value and create competitive advantage. Now, this is done by building a distinctive corporate capability and by raising its profile as a core integrating discipline within organizations. Now, mastering that discipline and being true to oneself can have a powerful effect in raising confidence and credibility when dealing with others. Key issues that define the discipline can be viewed as a focused value chain. So here are the key issues as I see them at the corporate level, and I've encompassed this within what I call the design management universe. We have design responsibility and leadership, which is at the core of design management as a discipline. We have corporate design philosophy and strategy formulation, positioning and visibility of design within organizations, the degree of integration and centralization of design within an organization, auditing corporate design and design management practices, introducing appropriate design management systems and infrastructure, establishing and maintaining corporate design standards and best practices. Incidentally, this is all in my paper, so don't bother whizzing down the thing. Further key issues at the corporate level are the environmental dimension of design, which includes sustainability and so on, the legal dimension of design, which includes exploiting intellectual property, corporate design capability, design awareness and design management skills development programs, design and the manifestation of corporate identity, evaluating the impact of design on corporate performance, funding design activities. So those are 14 key issues that define the scope of design management at the corporate level. Let's now move down to the project level, and we have the design. At the project level, we have the design process and different types of design project, the formulation of project proposals and the briefing process. We have the selection of design specialists and suppliers. We have the composition and management of augmented project teams. And these include a mix of design and design non-design people within and outside an organization, planning and administration of design projects, design project documentation and control systems. We have costing design work and drawing up project budgets. We have design research and sources of new investments in design. We have the presentation of design recommendations. We have the implementation and long-term survival of design solutions. And finally, the evaluation of design projects. I would now like to outline an approach developed in the early 90s for examining how organizations progress from novices to world-class performers, though it drew heavily from benchmarking, which was all the rage at the time. It is still powerful today. And in this, not only do we see the journey that companies go through, but we guide executives through analyses of their practices in some detail. And the outcome of that is an action plan to upgrade their performance. And here, I mean, don't bother reading it, but here is a two-page spread, which comes from a workbook, which shows the five-stage progression from novice to world-class. And you will see that the detail increases as you go through the five stages, because obviously you're getting more experience, you're getting more confident with how you are tackling. Well, this is one of the 25 key issues. Now, executives locate where they read these vignettes, descriptive vignettes, and they locate their organization at whatever stage they think reflects most closely with where their organization is. And following that, they are taken to a set, in this case, the 20 sets of practices, which are taken from the extremes of the spectrum. And basically, they form by circling where they see their organization along that spectrum. They form a profile of how they are addressing a particular issue. Now, you can understand... Oh, is that legible from most of from you? But here are some of the five entries which are extracted from that list. And you'll see that if an organization says we're at three, having read the descriptive vignettes, and they find that quite a few of their practices are at one and two, that immediately gives them a pointer as to where they are weak and where they should be concentrating their efforts. Does anybody want me to read from that? Or it's down, is it legible in the paper? I think it may be legible in the paper. But anyway, what happens? How are we doing on time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Oh, we're doing very well then. Okay. What happens is that having been through this, they're taken through a further set of questions which deal with things like, what do you think are the critical success factors in relation to this particular issue? What are the possible measurables? What represents excellence under this issue? Now, these provide insights into goals, internal benchmarks, priorities, and prime areas for undertaking external audits, comparing their performance with companies that they believe to be exemplars elsewhere. And of course, that is absolutely the substance of an action program to enhance their performance in that particular issue. So that is one way of dealing with how you enhance performance. So to conclude, as design management evolves as a discipline, we should latch on to the fittest. I mean, evolution goes with the fittest. We should latch on to the fittest, the strongest practitioners who have a vision and who pursue new directions and have the agility to stay ahead. So apart from drilling down to reveal increasingly the varied layers of detail and fleshing out the richness of the key issues, we need to discover and understand where design leadership emerges and how it yields strategic contributions. It is important to stress here that there are no quick, easy route to achieving excellence. Inevitably, all proposed solutions are partial. Clients, organizations, have to do the hard work to complete the solutions that are proposed. They have to complete them to their particular circumstances and keep them constantly under review. I still believe that basically they have to make them their own. We don't take away their problems, solve them, and bring back the solutions. They have to solve their own problems. We just help them do that. Now, I still believe that we need a consensus on the key issues that define design management as a rigorous discipline in business. 20 years ago, a survey confirmed that the ones included in my universe were of interest to organizations with a fair deal of experience in design management. We could test them out again now, and there may be many more issues that we would act. We could all do a great deal more to work to test views on what is considered world-class performance, especially as the discipline is now truly global. There is much attention now on designing experiences. Now, these typically relate to products and services. I think the time is right to focus on designing experiences on the design management journey. In other words, how organizations move from novices to world-class performance. And we need to document those experiences within an appropriate framework for the benefit of all. You can now unfasten your seatbelts. Thank you for traveling with Alto.